This podcast is brought to you by the IIEA, the Institute of International and European Affairs. Join the discussion on IIEA.com and access our engaging videos, blogs, and podcasts.
Okay, so first of all, I'd just like to stand back a little bit and make some observations about economic policy, which I think have been revealed through the crisis. The two here are interesting. The first one is, and this is really an indictment of economic policymaking, is if you look globally, there has been no consensus over what to do with fiscal policy. Now, there's a very legitimate question to pose to all economists, which is how have you had centuries to think about this problem, and you still can't agree what the right thing to do in a recession with fiscal policy is, right? So if you think that one of the key functions of economic policy is to prevent recessions or generate a recovery from recessions. So all of the major regions and geographies of the world have pursued completely different fiscal policies. And I'll come back to that. But that's a very curious state of affairs. The second one is that if you look at central banks, what's quite extraordinary is actually the policies of central banking and the tools of central banking haven't actually changed since the very first central banks started operating. So if you look at the Swedish Riksbank, which I think there are better experts here than me on central banking, but I think it's one of the first, if not the first, recognized central bank. The very first central banks in the late 1700s, what did they do? They did two things. They started and helped to finance the government. So they started government bond markets. That's actually QE. Right? So quantitative easing is exactly what central banks did at their very inception, which is buying government bonds. And then the second thing they did was provide liquidity to the banking system. And that's right at the origins. Now, the interesting thing is that despite all the fancy names and the complicated ways in which they do it, essentially they're doing exactly the same two things today. Now, that's quite extraordinary. Central banks went from being relatively small, not very significant institutions, to being the principal institutions of economic policymaking. And they actually haven't got any new tools. Nobody has really looked at it and said, if you had a blank sheet of paper, how would you organize a central bank today? So those are two, for me, very, very striking observations. Why can't we agree what to do with fiscal policy after all this time? And why has there been no innovation in the tools of central banking? And I would like to propose, really, one innovation in the tools of central banking, which I think would be a lot more effective. I should also say at the outset that a lot of this presentation will now get involved in very obtuse and abstract discussions of the distinction between fiscal and monetary policy. That's because I have to cover the fact that my policy prescription is blindingly obvious. Right? So when you look at it, it's kind of, and in fact, no economist ever says it won't work. So when you explain it to people, everybody pretty much accepts, you know, actually that would almost certainly work. But for some reason, economists and economic policymakers, particularly when we're confronted by very grave issues, we don't like the idea of very simple policies that would work with almost 100% certainty. Now, that in of itself is a very interesting psychological question. I suspect it actually is a psychological problem rather than being an economic one. Anyway, hopefully I'll convince you of that and we can discuss that during the Q&A. So the first thing we have to get out of the way is what is wrong with the Eurozone? Because to anybody observing it, or if you're not a specialist or you don't follow all of the policy dates, it's profoundly confusing. You have all of these different explanations from the fact that the Greeks don't work hard, the Italian legal system takes too long to get things through court, all of these complicated labor market reform, pensions. What is the root cause? Well, there are really two issues that economic policy tries to tackle. The first one is the economic cycle. So economic policy tries to prevent recessions, and when a recession occurs, it tries to generate recovery. And the second thing that policy focuses on is the long-term rate of GDP growth. Now, that's what all the structural reform is about. It's about long-term rate of GDP growth. So when you look at the demography, which determines labor supply, determines the burden of people in retirement, that's really about long-term growth rates. Demography doesn't cause financial panics and major recessions. It determines growth in the very long term. That's also true of labor markets. That's also true of welfare systems. Now, the problem cyclically, none of that explains labor market, structural reform, none of that explains why the Eurozone is in a recession stroke depression. Right? That is about pessimism and optimism. It really is as simple as that. Now, pessimism is effectively what Mario Draghi made an important speech recently at Jackson Hole in the United States. He said there isn't enough spending, there isn't enough aggregate demand in the Eurozone. Now, that all that means is households and businesses aren't spending enough. Now, why aren't they spending enough is because they're pessimistic. They're pessimistic, it's rational pessimism, because their pessimism is self-fulfilling. Right? So if I'm a worker, I'm worried that I'm going to lose my job, or I'm worried that my wages are going to be cut. So I don't spend very much. If I'm a firm, I think demand for my goods and services is going to be weak. I think my profits are going to be weak, so I don't invest. If I don't invest and I don't employ, the labor market is right to think that their wages are going to be cut, this job insecurity. It's very simple. So what really needs to be tackled, now the structural issue is complicated and ultimately, in my view, should be the remit of member states to decide what their long-run rates of growth are by setting their policies. But macroeconomic policy really needs to tackle this issue of pessimism and insufficient spending. Now, if you're studying for the Leaving Certificate, the answer to this problem is actually very straightforward. When I did economics at Leaving Cert many, many years ago, it would have been a very simple solution, which is you cut taxes, you increase government spending, and you cut interest rates. So the first question we have to ask ourselves is, why isn't that happening? Right? Why hasn't that been the policy prescription? That is, in effect, what America did. America, very, very late in the economic recovery, they started to cut back on government spending. But essentially, both Bush in 2008 and then the first thing that Obama did was cut taxes, increase government spending, and the Fed had been slashing interest rates. And it worked. Right? The U.S. economy has recovered. They're now getting, within 18 months, if things continue, America will be at full employment. So textbook economic policy has worked in the United States. So the interesting question then is, why hasn't the Eurozone followed what the United States did? Well, there's really, I think, two reasons. The first one is the fiscal policy is almost illegal. And there's sort of good reason for that, which is you don't have a federal government. So there's a major problem is how would you actually organize fiscal policy in the Eurozone if it isn't federalized? Because otherwise, any individual country can start setting policies independently. So the only way they could really get agreement, and particularly they very badly, in my view, made the fiscal compact in the midst of a crisis, has effectively neutered fiscal policy. There simply isn't enough flexibility to generate the kind of levels of demand that are necessary. So I met a senior official at the Italian finance ministry. The discussions the Italians are having with the European Commission are over 0.10 of a percentage point of their budget deficit. That doesn't even show up on an econometric model. Right? That is just simply statistical noise. If you want to have a fiscal impact, you need to do percentage points of GDP. So fiscal policy is severely hampered. Now, is monetary policy similarly hampered? Now, the problems with monetary policy have really arisen because, and this is why I want to talk about what would otherwise be an issue of semantics, this distinction between fiscal and monetary policy. So when European institutions were being put in place, in order to effectively give up sovereignty over the monetary authorities, it was very important that the delineation between fiscal and monetary policy was made clear. That is necessary effectively for the central bank to operate independently. If somehow fiscal policy could hijack monetary policy, the ECB wouldn't be able to operate with independence. So the inability to coordinate fiscal policy means it's extremely important that that legal distinction between fiscal and monetary policy is maintained. Now, part of the problem in the Eurozone, and this is what I want to come on to in a minute, is to illustrate that in a financial crisis, the distinction between fiscal and monetary policy effectively collapses. And actually, monetary policy becomes primary. And I'll come back to that in a minute. So the questions then that arise are, have we got a core fundamental weakness in the structure of the Eurozone? Because if in a financial crisis the distinction between monetary and fiscal policy collapse, how do we run a system where the two have to be separate legally? So is there a legal conflict with a fundamental need for counter-cyclical demand management? So how to solve the recession? And I will end, hopefully, by illustrating that I do actually think this circle can be squared. In other words, there is a Eurozone-specific policy that can solve this problem for us. Okay, so the distinction between fiscal and monetary policy. Now, most of us, if the two terms mean much at all, fiscal policy is understood as quite simply referring to taxation, government expenditure, and transfer payments by government. Monetary policy typically just is official interest rates, so the central bank changes interest rates. It can either raise the interest rate or cut interest rates. In that world, everything seemed pretty clear. There appears, superficially at least, to be a clear distinction between the two. Now, interestingly, if there are any economists or theoretical economists here, this actual distinction doesn't hold very well in economic theory. So if you read economic theory, actually, economists are very vague about this. Mervyn King was asked about the sort of policies I'm going to refer to, and he replied by saying, no, that's fiscal policy. And when actually, if you quiz him on the precise distinction, it starts to become very, very vague as to what the distinction is. In fact, a lot of theoretical models effectively make the two the same. That's really just, though, for the economists to bear in mind. I think we can make a relatively clear distinction. And the first one, monetary policy, I think you can clearly say has got to do with the issuance of currency. Right? So at least the role of monetary policy can be clearly defined there. And the second thing I think that we start to realize when you look into it is that actually the distinction is not really an abstract theoretical one. It's an institutional one. So monetary policy is, in fact, what we say the central bank should do. And fiscal policy is actually what we say the government should do. So this is important, though, because for a solution to be legal and viable in the Eurozone, it has to be true to that distinction. So it has to be clearly within the remit of the European Central Bank, operating independently of governments. That's absolutely key. And it has to involve the issuance of currency. In my view, that becomes indisputably monetary policy. If it's being done by the ECB independently of the behaviour of governments and involves the issuance of currency, that to me is both to the legal letter and also to the spirit of the definition. Okay, now, before I come to the specific proposal, I just want to illustrate this point about what happens in a financial crisis. So why the distinction between fiscal and monetary policy collapses. So previously we had this clear, apparently clear distinction. Tax expenditure is fiscal. Creation of money and interest rates is the central bank. There's a profound observation about political organization in the work of David Hume writing in the 1700s. And again, political organization is probably the one area which has been even slower to move in terms of genuine innovation than economics, which is not necessarily a bad thing. Now, Hume argues that there are three spontaneous institutions of social organization. So any society that you look at will have these three institutions. And what I really want to suggest to you is that in a financial crisis, you realize that sovereignty actually depends on our ability to issue currency. Right? So it's something that we ignore most of the time, and it only very rarely becomes relevant to a society. But actually, the ability to issue currency is extremely important. Money today is the financial system. Now, beneath the financial system, there are effectively, in most societies, developed countries, two contractual obligations. Right. One is that the state will support deposits, to varying magnitude, but we have to have deposit guarantees. Otherwise, we will have systematic collapse and threaten social stability. Right. Now, this is only made explicit in recent developments, but it's actually always there. And if Milton Friedman talks about this as one of the most important changes in the US economy after the Great Depression was the introduction of deposit insurance. It really ended the kind of very frequent banking panics that used to occur in the 1800s. The second implicit guarantee that is absolute is that the government won't default on its debt. Now, effectively, what happened in the... Now, the interesting question is, can a sovereign state do that if it doesn't control money?